During World War II, my grandfather served as a specialist in the U.S. Army in the Pacific Theater. After hostilities were at an end, my grandfather was one of the first people on mainland Japan. His role changed from a combat role to more of a support role, that haunted him until his death. He was responsible for driving generals, admirals, VIPs, senators, representatives into the Hiroshima nuclear blast zone to see exactly what a nuclear bomb does from a devastation standpoint and to the people and the surroundings. He suffered radiation burns just from the proximity. Every day he had to visit a military hospital where they're taking care of civilian casualties. And this deeply, deeply affected him. My grandfather shared these stories with me, and as far as I know, seemingly only me. And they always ended with a warning, or a mandate, if you will, that I needed to do whatever I could do in this world to make sure that another nuclear weapon was never used again. With that in mind, I went to university and got a degree in computer science. I found that I had a semi-unique talent, that I was very good at sorting through large amounts of data, as well as making computers break and basically do whatever I wanted to. I was a hacker. With that newly found skills, I found myself as a junior analyst working for the National Security Agency in Signals Intelligence. I quickly found out that I had a very good affinity for this work, so much so that I went from a low-level analyst to a technical leader in under 6 years, a career progression that normally takes about 25 to 30 years. I invented many, many capabilities, hacking capabilities that they call computer network exploitation capabilities, novel research, R&D, cutting-edge cyber capabilities. I was recognized by my peers globally throughout this global intelligence collective called the Five Eyes, which comprised most of the English-speaking nations, Canada, New Zealand, America, Australia, and the United Kingdom. So much so that I was asked to present. I was sent overseas to present in the UK, in Canada, teaching people, learning from me. I once invented a capability that is was pretty amazing, and I presented this capability in front of a global audience of 2,500 people just to see what this new cyber capability, truly a enemy of the state-esque capability that we could use. Throughout my career, I ended up ultimately working in computer operations, and I was put in charge of a division that was, its mandate was gain access to any computer, anytime, anywhere in the world. I worked counterproliferation and counterterrorism. I would frequently work nights. My wife would sometimes got to such a habit where she didn't even know I was gone. I was called in at 1 a.m., 2 a.m., working emergencies, primarily around counterterrorism. I'd work and live at the agency at Fort Meade sometimes for days at a time. Longest time I ever spent without coming home was 10 days during an emergency and crisis. You know, everything was going pretty well. We were stopping terrorist attacks. I worked the Boston terrorist bombings. I worked several other capture-kill operations against anti-terrorism overseas. I deployed undercover to Afghanistan and to Iraq and to other Middle Eastern countries, supporting CIA and Special Forces operations. Until one fateful day, In May 2013, I was called to the director's office, the director of National Security Agency. This is a rare occurrence. And there are 90,000-ish employees working in this space globally. Not everyone sees the director on a daily basis, especially not, you know, still as a technical leader, I considered myself a worker bee. I was informed at that meeting that I was going to be working for a task force and that a contractor in working for NSA Hawaii had just left the compound flew to Hong Kong with a trove of top secret and special compartmented information. My new mandate was to help identify what is the intelligence loss, as well as try to track down this individual so that he could be extradited by the FBI back to the United States for his crimes. If you haven't guessed by now, this individual was Edward Snowden. I didn't come home for 5 days. I was sequestered. I was working. The devastation and the knowledge of what was stolen and eventually unlawfully disclosed was sinking in. And I learned that in addition to some of the first droppings talking about the PRISM program, that Mr. Snowden had a special affinity for the types of capabilities that I was developing, and in fact stole several documents, including that presentation that I gave to 2,500 people about this major capability that I invented and worked with several colleagues upon, probably the number one capability allowing us to capture terrorists across the globe. I got special dispensation that day, where I was allowed, well, in fact, mandated that I needed to call my family. First, I had to explain to my wife that we were now in grave danger. My name is attached to several documents, classified documents, that may or may not be used by another nation state. We didn't know the intentions at the time to find me, locate me. After that, I had to call my parents. For the first time, after 8 years, I had to give them an insight into what I actually did for a living, and explain to them that their lives were now in danger because of the activities that I was doing. I had to call my brother and his wife, and he had just had 3 months prior to that his second son. He was about 3 months old, and inform him that I have put his new family in danger because of the capabilities that were disclosed. Similarly, we had to call my wife's parents and my niece and nephew and her brother. It was a hard day. I was extremely saddened and extremely worried about what was happening. Later on, probably about a week later, I'm driving home from my work at Fort Meade on 295, and my cell phone is sitting in the passenger seat of my car. I see the phone flash white, flash black, and then computer code starts screening across the screen. And then eventually Chinese characters start screening, going across the screen. I mildly freaked out. I quick pulled the battery from my phone, removed the case, basically cracked it in half while I was doing it, and then came home. At the time, my niece and nephew were visiting, hanging out with my wife. She sees me come in the door. My face is white. My phone is in pieces. She quickly knows that this is not a normal way that I come home from work. She sends my niece and nephew into the backyard to play, and I have to tell her that my phone was just hacked on my way back from work. More than likely, it was another nation that was trying to gain access to my mobile device to locate me and identify additional intelligence about me and my personal life. That I can live with. That's part of the game. That's honestly, you know, a risk that I knew I was taking as an intelligence officer. We immediately both got new phones. We changed kind of our pattern of life a little bit, changed numbers, all of that, informed our family and friends of new contact information, and kind of dealt with it. The one thing that the government doesn't prepare you for is the government has a lot of support for the government, but as an intelligence officer, they do not protect you as an individual. You are responsible for yourself and your life. That's was hard to sink in. I informed people. They used the forensic information from my device. They went to try to figure out where it was detected. It originated from China. At this point, Edward Snowden is in Russia, and I'm informed that I'm not allowed to travel to many, many countries. Shortly after that, Der Spiegel in Germany, basically the Time magazine of Germany, publishes another disclosure about the cyber capability that I had invented. And up until this time, they had been redacting people's names from the documents, you know, just showing, you know, what the big bad U.S. government was doing. And they were being very kind to the individual officers that were doing these things or inventing them. However, someone made a mistake. My name was published with the document fully. And about 24 hours after that, the death threats started to roll in. I was receiving them primarily via email. Again, the government really wasn't going to help me. Luckily, I have a lot of friends and colleagues spread across the technical security apparatus in private industry. And we were able to track down that it was an individual in Missouri, alt-right, privacy, person concerned about privacy. It's okay. I could handle sort of digital threats coming to me. However, one day I'm leaving for work, and taped to our mailbox is a note. I open this note. It's actually a picture of my wife and I standing on our porch, taken surreptitiously, with our faces crossed out with red marker, eyes crossed out, X's across our faces, with the words, "We're going to fucking kill you." Immediately after that, I had to put some other plans in action. We moved. I created a support role for myself over in the United Kingdom. I went and became a special advisor, special liaison to the United Kingdom, and helped them in this era of lost intelligence, regain some of the intelligence loss that the United Kingdom had lost, and was a great partner to the United States. We lived over there for several years. My family and I, or my wife and I, the death threats digitally kept coming. Luckily, they couldn't exactly pinpoint us where we had moved to. After several years, I realized that I'd kind of hit the pinnacle of my career. I have done amazing things to kind of fulfill the request from my grandfather. I worked very successful counterproliferation operations. I you know, I'm very proud of the anti-terrorism aspects of my job. Saved countless lives, both overseas and in the United States, due to some of the activities me and my colleagues have done. But realized that I was a frickin' mess. One thing working for the intelligence community is that is extremely frowned upon is that you're not really allowed to seek mental health services, or at least there's a unwritten taboo about going to a therapist or seeking any therapy, in because you may lose your clearance. You obviously can't talk to several people about mental health conditions, and you can't obviously say anything classified that you were working on. So I realized that it was time to finally make a move. I decided that we were going to leave my job working for the U.S. government, go and work for private industry, and actually seek help for some of the mental conditions and mental strife that I was having. Worked with an excellent therapist through several events. Obviously, the death threats are extremely concerning, but other things that I witnessed, horrible, bloody conflict while I was undercover in Iraq, I'm diagnosed with PTSD. Still, obviously, trying to overcome my anxieties and work through these PTSD issues. You know, I felt that I was doing my grandfather proud, but one of the things, and actually our last meeting before he died, he told me, "Garrett, I wish that you had never gone and worked for the National Security Agency, only seeing what was published publicly without seeing the other side of the story." I couldn't tell him the great works that I had done. Most of my family still doesn't know anything that I have done. And that hurt because I couldn't share this, you know, that I had done it for him, that I had tried to, make him proud and do what he had asked me to do several years ago. He passed away in the last few years, and part of me actually thinks in today's climate, did I make the right decision? Should I have stayed with the government? Should I have continued to work counterproliferation, especially as we look today at the things that are happening in North Korea and the other escalations across the world in terrorism and other types of things. Unfortunately, I just couldn't do it. I couldn't do it to my family anymore. I couldn't do it to myself. And I'm hoping that tonight, that this, by telling a little bit of this story, that I'll get a little bit of closure about this. Thank you.